Hey guys, this is kind of like an emergency impromptu podcast I did with Mark Oliva and of the NSSF, and we're talking about the HR 8 bill and what it really means. I urge you to listen to the whole thing through and then contact your senators and some of these key senators that we talked about in this conversation. This bill, I think they vote on it on the 23rd. Today's the 18th. We do have some time to affect some change. So listen to it and contact those senators. Thank you. Hi, welcome to the Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast. Today we are going to talk a little bit about gun control and this bill that's out there and looming over our heads, the HR 8. I have Mark Oliva with us, from the Director of Public Affairs from NSSF, and he's going to shed a little light, and we're going to kind of talk about the implications of this bill and what it means, and hopefully kind of get down to the nitty gritty, because we're getting fed a lot of different stuff, and I like to hear it from the horse's mouth. So how's it going, Mark?
Hey, how you doing, John? I appreciate you having me today.
Yeah, absolutely. Real quick, I'm gonna just give a little rundown about yourself, and then we'll hit this.
Yeah, so I'm the Director of Public Affairs for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. I work with our government relations team, who is focused a lot on the legislative issues on Capitol Hill and the legislative issues in each of the state capitals. The NSSF itself is the Firearm Industry Trade Association. We represent your manufacturers, both for firearms and ammunition. Pretty much from everything from the guys who are stamping out the blanks to make the receivers for your firearms to your mom and pop retail shops who are selling you your guns and ammo at the local store. And we kind of cover their interests. We're a trade association just like any other trade association. Just happens to be our product is firearms and ammunition. A lot of people always ask, you know, what's the difference between who we are and kind of what the NRA is? Really, that dividing point is the gun counter. Everything that we do is to make sure that that gun can get to the counter. And then once it crosses that counter when you buy it, that's really where the NRA kind of picks up and takes care of your ability to be able to exercise your Second Amendment rights. So, you know, that's kind of where we're at. We couldn't do what we do without the Second Amendment, but we're not a civil rights Second Amendment organization like the NRA is. We're a trade association, but just our business is the business of guns and ammo.
Right. Awesome. So let's talk about what does this bill say, or, you know, what are they toting it as, really?
Well, it sounds really good on a bumper sticker when you say universal background checks, doesn't it? I mean, we all want the background check system to work the way it's intended, and that's how these gun control politicians are pushing. They just want to make the background check system work. Every gun sold should have a background check. Well, the truth is that every gun that's sold at retail is sold with a background check. Whether right. you buy that gun at a mom and pop brick and mortar location, or you buy it at a gun show, or you buy it at through online sales, every transaction has to be completed with a face to face transaction completed with a background check through the FBI's National List of Criminal Background Check System.
Right.
And that means filling out that 4473 like we've all done. So they try to make it sound like, you know, there's all sorts of problems with this, when in actuality there aren't. And so HRH would essentially criminalize the ability for you, John, to be able to sell your neighbor of 10 years a hunting rifle that he's always had his eye on, and you decide now it's time to go ahead and part with it. If you sold that to him without a background check facilitated through a licensed retailer, you could be facing criminal action. And really the problem with these bills isn't so much in the name. I mean, again, the name sounds great, but
right.
The problem with the bills was when you start to really get into the details, and that's where the devil really lies. And the first one, and probably the biggest one, is that HR 8 allows for the creation of a national firearm registry, which right now is against the law. The 1986 Firearm Owner Protection Act says the U.S. government, federal government, cannot keep a federal database of who is a gun owner and who's not a gun owner. But what this bill would allow them to do is create that national database that would put every law-abiding citizen who chooses to exercise their Second Amendment rights on a government watch list. And you got to ask yourself, well, why would the government need to watch me for exercising my rights? There's no other right that they would put you on a list to watch you.
Right.
You wouldn't be on that list if you chose to read your news from Fox News or you chose to read your news from CNN. They wouldn't put you on a watch list because you chose to go to, you know, the Church of Christ down the road versus going to the mosque on the other end of town. There's no watch list that they put you on because you chose to take part in a protest and let your government know that you're not happy with what they're doing. But the Second Amendment right, they want to put you on a watch list and monitor you. And that no longer makes it a right. That makes it an allowance. That makes it a privilege.
Right.
And that's not that's not what our country is founded upon. You, at your birth as an American, have the right endowed by your creator to keep and bear arms. As long as you're a law-abiding citizen, you can exercise that right at your will. And this is no longer putting that on the will. It's putting on the government watching you because you happen to own a gun and you exercise your right. And we have a very serious concern about our customers being put on lists for exercising their rights. And the first step of confiscation, of course, list. You can't seize the guns unless you know where the guns are at. And this would put everybody on that list. And that's a very frightening prospect that could be coming to the American public.
Oh yeah, for sure. I know it's like they've been saying this for years, toting it around for years, saying that 90% of Americans support this. And it's so funny because I went and did a little research. One of the polls that they cite when they're talking about this is the, I'm going to mess up this name, but the Quinnipiac University polls.
Quinnipiac, yeah.
Quinnipiac, thank you.
Yeah,
and I know in 2017, in June of 2017, they did a poll. And the poll, first off, the first thing I found wrong with it is I end up finding out that they only polled 1,212 voters. 1,212 voters of, what, 329 million people in the United States? That's kind of a small, section of people to derive that 90% of Americans support this. But then I went and looked at the actual question. It says, do you support or oppose requiring background checks for gun buyers? And it's like, well, of course I'd support it because we do it. Every time I go buy a gun, I do it.
Yeah, it's one of those rhetorical questions that you just can't answer correctly. So, Congressman, at what level of discrimination are you comfortable with, right? You know, so it's never going to be something that is going to actually get into the details of, all right, you know, if you pose that same question to those same people, are you opposed to, you know, law-abiding citizens of America to be put on watch lists for exercising their fundamental civil liberties.
Right.
I'm sure 98-99% of Americans would say, hell no, we're not gonna support that. So yeah, it's always a nice question is when you have very broad questions to a bumper sticker, a title of a bill, it's something that they like to, you know, kind of parade around and say, look, everyone supports it. But once you start to get past the surface of this, it becomes very, very problematic. One of the other problems that we have as the industry with this is it really doesn't address, you know, what's supposed to happen to that retailer who has to facilitate those background checks when something goes wrong with try to transfer that firearm. So let's say, John, just for instance, you and I want to go in and I want to sell you that old pump shotgun I've had in the back of my gun safe that I haven't used for years. And it's time for me to let that have a better home, right?
Right.
And so we walk into Joe's gun shop I want to transfer that firearm to you, and the retailer runs a background check on you. When you come back as a prohibited individual, and the background check's going to tell you one of three things. It's going to tell you proceed, delay, or deny. So it comes back and says deny. And it's never going to tell you why. It's just going to say deny.
Right.
So the retailer can't give you that gun because he now knows you're a prohibited individual. If he gives you that gun, he's breaking the law. He can go to jail. And he's going to lose his license, certainly. So before he gives that gun back to me, he's like, let me just do the right thing and run a background check on me, because he wants to make sure he's not putting a gun into the hands of somebody who shouldn't have it, right? He wants to be a fine, upstanding citizen of his community. He's concerned about the safety of his neighborhoods. So he runs a background check on me. Well, it comes back and says deny again. Well, now what is he supposed to do? Because he can't give the gun to you, and he can't give the gun to me, but he has no legal authority to seize that firearm. What is he supposed to do then? You know, so it puts that retailer in a legal quandary as to what he's supposed to do and how he's supposed to dispose of that firearm. He can't seize it. He has no legal authority to do that. He can't give that gun back to anybody, because if he gives it back to the original owner or person who claims to be the owner and they're a prohibited individual, he's breaking a federal law and he's risking his license. So, and part of this too is really starts to get down to some of the details that a lot of people don't understand about how retailers work, is that every firearm that comes into a retail location has to be logged in and out of an A&D book or an acquisitions and dispositions book. So when that firearm comes into that store, they acquire it. So they have to put it into the acquisitions column. Received this firearm serial number X on this date. And then when it's disposed of, they have to log that out of the dispositions call. You know, they've disposed of that firearm. It's now been sold to this individual on this date, and this is the serial number of that firearm. Well, that has to happen each and every time the firearm comes in and goes out of their custody. So what the bill authors would rather you do is, don't do that. Just run the background checks first, and then if everything's fine, then log it in. Mm-hmm. So you're telling the retailer, follow the law, but ignore the federal regulation, and you risk your license with the ATF because now you're not doing your logbooks correctly. So you could have your license revoked, and you could lose your business. So, I mean, this is where we start to say, this goes down rabbit holes very quickly that lead to nowhere and aren't doing anything. And let's be honest. This bill isn't solving any of these issues that they're talking about. When we look at, they'd like to look at these tragic incidents and terrible incidents,
right,
of murder in Parkland, Florida, Sutherland Springs, even in where we are based in Newtown, Connecticut. And none of these issues would have been stopped with a quote unquote universal background check system. We look at the Newtown tragedy, and that tragedy started with the very first crime of that individual stealing his own mother's rifle. The second crime he committed was killing his own mother with her rifle before he went down to the school and committed all those horrific crimes down at that school. Mm-hmm. And the Sutherland Springs incident, and in Sutherland Springs, Texas, the murderer in that incident was a prohibited individual three times over. He had been dishonorably discharged from the Air Force. He had been convicted of a domestic violence incident when he was in the Air Force, and he had been involuntarily committed to a mental health facility. Each of those singularly made him a prohibited individual, but the Air Force never submitted the background information to the FBI. But they never submitted it. He was able to go out five different times and buy firearms, and each time the retailer ran a background check on him, wanting to do the right thing, following the law, following the regulation, and the background check system failed because the information that was supposed to have been put in there wasn't being put up there. And it wasn't because that retailer did anything wrong. It's because the Air Force, the federal government, failed in their duty. So if we start to look at this, when we start looking at these things, we want to solve these problems. Well, we want to solve these problems too, but all this is doing is putting roadblocks in front of law-abiding citizens to be able to exercise their rights. It's actually not doing anything to stop criminal activity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, if I was a criminal, the first thing I'm going to do, if I want to go get a weapon to use in a crime, I'm not going to go to a place where I could get tracked from, you know? It's like, it's not going to prevent people from, you know.
And the FBI has said this year after year. They put out a report called the Uniform Crime Report, and that tells us exactly, you know, what crimes are being committed with what firearms. But they also put out supplemental reports from time to time, and one of those from the Department of Justice, and it was a survey of inmates who had committed felonies with firearms, and they asked them, "Where did you get your firearm?" And over 90% of those felons said that they got their firearm through nefarious means. I mean, they got it through the black market. They stole it. They got it from a buddy, you know, on the street corner. It was a gun that was being traded among several gang members, but it wasn't something that they went to a brick-and-mortar location, put their name on a 4473, and said, "Yeah, I'm going to be the owner of this gun. I'm the true recipient, and I've never been convicted of a crime, and I'm not a fugitive from justice." And all those questions that you and I have had to answer, that's not where they're getting their firearms. They're getting it through illicit means. And they've told us, so we know this is the case. So instead of going after the criminal, all they're doing is putting more roadblocks in front of you as a law-abiding citizen. They're making it more difficult for you to be able to transfer that firearm to somebody who may need that. You have a neighbor who you know is going through a terrible divorce and is being threatened by her husband, and you know that this is a very real situation. And so you are now going to be prohibited from saying, "Listen, I want you to hold on to my handgun for the next few days until things cool down, because I don't want you to become a victim of domestic violence incident." That will now become illegal.
Now, along those lines, I've read articles that say yay and some that say nay on this situation. What if I want to lend my rifle to a buddy who's going hunting?
Yeah, so it's one of those little areas where it says you can't knowingly hand that rifle to somebody that you believe is going to be, you know, using it for criminal activity or a reason to believe is a criminal, which of course is already the law. You can't transfer a firearm to anybody who's a prohibited individual. But what this also says is you can't take that firearm and say, "Listen, we're going to go hunt the back 40, and I'm going to put you in this deer stand over here, and then I'm going to be on the other side of the property in this deer stand." Well, that you're only allowed to hand that firearm if you're going to be in the same proximate location as that person. So what is proximity now? Is it in the same deer stand? Is it within eyesight? You know, I certainly think that those who want to press the envelope would say that, you know, being on the other side of a 400-acre property is not in the same proximity. I
Oh,
can't see what that person's doing
no.
with that firearm.
No.
So now it becomes a very difficult thing where you want to take somebody out and introduce them to hunting, that if you're not right alongside them and you want to be a law-abiding citizen and you want to make sure you're staying within the confines of the law, that means you're going to have to be, you know, nearly glued to their hip the whole time that they're carrying your firearm.
Yeah, so me as a guide, I mean, I constantly, you know, lend firearms to clients that come,
Yeah.
you know, because they don't want to travel with guns or
Ex
whatever.
exactly. Yeah, exactly. And we, especially you as a guide and those in the guiding industry, I mean, how many times something goes wrong with somebody's rifle? How many times someone's optics are, you know, they get broken? You know, something happens and that you know, they're looking at you because they're paying a pretty good chunk of change out of their wallet to come do the hunt of a lifetime. And they're looking at you, and you know you've got to, you know, you're the only thing now that's going to help them make that week-long trip or that long weekend trip a success, because you have the working firearm that you know is going to work correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
And that puts you in a very difficult position, because that client that you may not be taking, I mean, you may be taking out into the woods with you may not have a personal relationship with that person.
I mean,
So
most of the time
you
I
got to
don't.
rely on your instinct.
Yeah,
Yeah,
most of the time I
exactly.
don't know what
It's
I
not that you're
select to
taking.
draw, you know.
Yeah. You're not taking your second cousin out there who, you know, has always wanted to chase down that rack of a lifetime. And so, you know, you've really got to be asking yourself, am I doing the right thing here? And it puts a lot of people in a very difficult situation of, you know, am I doing the right thing? And again, that kind of comes back to that situation. You've got a neighbor who. who may be in a precarious situation because of a family dispute or a domestic dispute. And you want to make sure that person is going to be able to save, you know, themselves because of threats that have been made against that person's life. And you can't hand them that gun. That becomes illegal now.
Yeah. That is, yeah. It's crazy. I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit, you know.
Sure.
What are some of the things that they can do, you think, in your opinion? Obviously, it's just your opinion, but to, you know, maybe beef up our current system that doesn't require, you know, what – I know they're trying to pass another law. So is it the 1446?
Yeah, H.R. 1446, what they call the so-called Charleston loophole law, the enhanced background check law. And again, that's a very problematic bill as well, and that moved right alongside of H.R. 8. That's a bill that's being written by Representative James Clyburn out of South Carolina, and he points to the incident of the shooting at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston as to why he believes that bill is needed. What that bill does, instead of, you know, you go in to buy a firearm right now, mm-hmm. and if you don't get you. Said you'll get one of three responses on that background check from the FBI, and it's going to say proceed, delay, deny. Now, if you get a delay, that means the FBI needs to look into this a little bit more. It could be something simple as a lot of people don't want to put their social security number on that 4473, mm-hmm. And you're not required to. Makes things a little bit easier, but you know, maybe you don't. Maybe your name is John Smith, and you were born on a particular day in New York City, and there were, you know, 17 other John Smiths born in New York City on that same day and in that same borough of New York, right?
Right.
And so, you know, seven of those 17 are felons, and they've got to make sure that you're not felon John Smith and that you're law-abiding John Smith. So they may need to look into that just further. And that's why you may get a delay. And after 72 hours, if the FBI has not responded back to the retailer, then they have the authority. They may, they're not required to, they may transfer that firearm to you. A lot of your big box retailers just won't do it. And that's a company policy just because they have such high traffic. They don't know those people.
Right.
But it comes down to, again, maybe you're working with your local small town retailer who you've known your whole life. And he knows that you're a law-abiding citizen. You get that delay notification. And 72 hours come back, he hasn't heard, and he says, I'm comfortable with making this transfer. He doesn't have to, but he can if he wants after 72 hours. What this bill would do now is extend that delay period up to 10 days. Mm-hmm. That's 10 business days.
Okay.
So if a disposition doesn't come back within that first 10 days, then it would go into a second 10-day period. Now, during the second 10-day period, it's no longer the FBI who's trying to figure out if you're felon John Smith or law-abiding John Smith. It's up to you to prove to the government under this bill that you are law-abiding. And that kind of runs counter to what we have as a system of presumption of innocence in America, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Now I have to prove to the government that I'm law-abiding. Wait a second. You're the ones telling me I can't exercise my rights. You should be proving to me that I'm a prohibited individual. But on top of that, after that second 10-day delay status, it can actually go into an indefinite delay because now, depending on when you buy that and in what month you buy that in, that could run out the clock on the 30 days of which a 4473 is good for. You fill out that form 4473 and you sign and date it. That form is only good for 30 days. So if you go into this cycle of delays and you come up on that 30-day mark, you have to fill out that form and start all over again, knowing you're going to get the same damn results again. So it could be an endless delay. And then we remind people, when your rights are delayed, your rights are being denied. Right. And that's a very serious concern for our customers. We want to make sure that they're able to exercise their rights. And again, the whole system was set up with that 3-day delay to be able to allow for those John Smith situations. And the fact is 91% of the people who purchase a firearm get an instant notification. I think the most I've ever waited on a background check is probably 30 seconds. I'll say maybe even a minute, but I've never had any kind of issue. Again, I'm one of those people who I'll put my social security number down. And maybe that's it. And I'm, you know, I know there's a few other Mark Olivas out there, but, you know, I don't think there's, you know, tremendous amounts of us. But, you know, I think that, you know, when we start to look at the numbers, you know, 91% of the people get an instant proceed delay or, you know, proceed or deny notification. Mm-hmm. The remaining 9% may get the delay. Of those 9% that go into delay, 84% of those are resolved within those 3 business days. And of those remaining, that 16% now that are becoming a very small piece of that pie, are resolved actually within 10 business days. And the remaining portion of those are never resolved. But again, that's incumbent upon the government to prove that you are actually a prohibited individual. So again, these bills become very problematic. And when we start to look at the roots of the Charleston Emanuel AME shooting, the murder that happened there, the murders, mm-hmm. It wasn't a matter of the background check system not working. That individual had a criminal history. The only part was his criminal history was sitting in the bottom of a courthouse in South Carolina, and those records were never submitted to the FBI. Hmm. So when the FBI put him on a delay and said, hey, we need more information, no one went down to the basement of that courthouse to dig out those records. So it was a matter of local authorities not sharing the information with the FBI. When the FBI didn't get the answers they needed within 72 hours, they followed the law. And they told that retailer, you can transfer that firearm if you want. And he did. And unfortunately, this individual went out and committed heinous acts with that firearm. So really what we need to be concentrating on, you know, you can ask the devil's advocate question of, you know, what can we do?
Yeah.
Well, we really need to be making sure the background check system works as intended. That's something that the fire ministry has been involved with, you know, since 2013. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when we took a look and we said, hey, listen, the background check system is not working the way it was intended. You know, at the time, you know, you had states that were not submitting all disqualifying adjudicated mental health records to the FBI. And those are those instances when, you know, a judge steps in and said, listen, you are criminally insane. We're not giving you a choice in this matter anymore. You are going to a mental health facility and going to get treatment, whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. And those records make you a prohibited individual. We have changed the law in 16 states to get them to do that. We actually changed the law at the federal level too to get them to do that. The Fix NICS Act. We had 78 senators sign on to that bill. You probably had your most pro-Second Amendment senator, Senator John Cornyn out of Texas, lead that bill. And he named it after our campaign because he believed in what we were doing. And you had probably the most pro-gun control senator come aboard as the lead co-sponsor. And that's Senator Murphy out of Connecticut, who's never met a gun bill he didn't like.
Right.
And he'll certainly sign his name onto any gun control bill. But he saw that this was, you know, we talk about common sense middle ground. This is it. Mm-hmm. We had 78 senators sign on to that bill. And you couldn't get 78 senators to sign a birthday card. But they did it for this. And we got that bill passed and put into law to make the federal government do what they're supposed to do. Get the Air Force to submit that disqualifying record to the FBI and give the states the resources that they need to get all those adjudicated mental health records, those criminal records to the FBI that need to be in there. Because of the efforts that we've put in there, it's been well over 200% increase of those records. When we started this, it was about 1.7 million records that were in there for adjudicated mental health records back in 2014 is when we hit the ground running with this. And as we closed out 2020, we were over 6 million records. There were adjudicated mental health records saying you cannot be trusted with a firearm. So this is where we get it. We still have 3 states that are holding out. You have Montana, Wyoming, and New Hampshire are still holding out. And we're continuing to work with those states to try and get them to understand the need to supply the FBI with all the information to make the background check system work as intended. If Congress was serious about this, mm-hmm. they would give the FBI and the ATF the resources they need to make that check system work the way it's intended, to make sure that they have enough people staffing that system, to make sure that they can run through those records, to make sure those records are accurate. But we're the ones, the industry has actually been in there with members of Congress, telling them to plus up the FBI's budget to give them the resources that they need and give the ATF the resources they need to make sure that the regulation inspections that they're doing are running smoothly and not delaying our retailers and our manufacturers from being in business. Congress wasn't doing that on their own. If these gun control politicians were serious about that, that's what they'd be doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Going back to the to the background check. I thought about this the other day, and I was like, and I don't know how, obviously I don't know how this would be worded or written into it or whatever, but to me, if they had it as an option, say like I want to sell a gun and I don't know, a friend of a friend of a friend's like, hey, I know this guy that's got a gun that he wants to sell. And, you know, just to cover my own ass, I wanted to get this guy background checked before I transferred it. You know, that I can see. But, you know, and like you were just talking about having people in the government be really proactive about getting the FBI. Like, those things all make sense. Because, I mean, again, goes back to what we were saying earlier, is that, you know, criminals are going to do what criminals do, no matter what.
By their nature. That's why they call them criminals, right?
You know, you put a door on something, they figure out how to get through the door. You put a bigger lock on that door, they figure out how to get through there. You put it in a safe, they figure out how to get into that. I mean, so it doesn't really matter how many roadblocks you put up. If a guy wants to do something that, you know, bad enough, they're going to do it. They're going to find a way. I mean, just look at drugs. No matter what we do, you know, they're finding ways to get it over the border. They're finding, you know, tunnels up people's butts. You know, you name it. They figure out a way to do it. So, yeah, I don't see it solving any of the problems. And I don't think anybody really does, except for people who are brainwashed and follow along with, you know, what their sheep herders tell them to do. But
you know, I think it's a lot of these gun control politicians know the reality, and these bills aren't being written to solve the issues of criminal misuse of firearms or any kind of crime.
Yeah,
these bills are being written to chip away at your rights,
exactly,
and to give the government more say over your ability to buy the firearm if you're choosing, and decide if that's the firearm that you need, and to be able to use it the way you want to within a lawful manner.
Right.
So it really comes down to, if they're serious, enforce the damn laws you have on the books. They have plenty of laws, but they're not enforcing the laws that they want. They're serious about solving criminal misuse of firearms. Quit turning out felons into the streets.
Right.
Quit setting them free with, you know, with no bail, and just watching them go out same crimes over and over again. But that's not what we're seeing.
Right. Yep. And giving asylum to, you know, illegals that may or may not be here for, you know, for reasonable and purposes, you know. But it's like, I don't know. I don't actually know what, I'm not going to go down that road. It's a little too political, but I do want to get into something that's a little bit more on the politics side. Is I know that they're using this bill specifically as a tool or something, a good way to put it, I guess, to get rid of the filibuster.
Yeah, so
I
think
Schumer, was it Schumer?
Yeah.
Kind of spearheading that whole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Senator Schumer is your majority leader in the Senate now. And interestingly, you know, 2-3 years ago, he was standing in the well of the Senate, you know, talking about the need to preserve the filibuster, you know, that it was necessary for the Senate to function the way it needs to function. And now he's among those who's saying it's time to get rid of the filibuster, which would make the House, make the Senate just like the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And so for your listeners who may not understand, the House of Representatives runs by sheer majority. And the majority always rules. So all it takes is one more vote to pass what you want to pass in the House. So when Democrats and Republicans vote on party lines, their issue is going to rule the day as long as they have the majority of votes. And 9 times out of 10, you're going to see a lot of bills move out of the House because they're going to move along party lines. There's going to be a little bit of arm twisting that happens to make sure that these things move and to get pushed out of the House. Those bills can be coming through at a very high rate, very quickly, without a lot of debate. And that's what we saw with H.R. 8 and H.R. 1446, those two gun control bills we talked about. They were introduced. They were not offered for any committee debate or what they call markup, where they could say, okay, let's strike this word, but add this word, make this better. None of that input was allowed. They went straight to the floor of the House of Representatives, and it was voted on within 9 days. 9 days from introduction till it was passed out and went over to the Senate. Now, the way the Senate is supposed to work, and they pride themselves on being the, quote, most deliberative legislative body in the world. And Thomas Jefferson talked about it, and he said the Senate was the cooling saucer for the hot tea. So all the hot tea would come out of the House because everyone was all fired up about their idea. And it would come over to the Senate, and they would, you'd pour out a little bit of that hot tea onto the saucer and just kind of let it cool down a bit. Let's let cooler heads prevail. Let's just talk this through and debate it out. And that's what the filibuster is there for. It's kind of a big, heavy hammer, and it makes the senators kind of collaborate a little bit more than maybe the congressmen and congresswomen over in the House of Representatives. They don't have to do that nearly as much. They can do it by majority rule. And so what that is a 60-vote threshold to be able to move that particular bill to final vote. They've chipped away at that filibuster over the years. First it was for presidential nominees for office. And then it was, and this started under Harry Reid, under the Democrats. Harry Reid was the majority leader, he chipped away at that first. And then it became an issue for Republicans when they were trying to push through nominees for the Supreme Court. And so they rolled back the filibuster rule on Supreme Court nominees. Now the Democrats are seeing that, they're not going to be able to maybe get their independent. So they're looking at saying, well, maybe we need to roll that back completely for any kind of issue. And so there are people who want to see the filibuster go, who are going to be using this debate as fuel for the fire. Senator Kaine out of Virginia, a very vocal anti-gun senator, has said that, he does not want to see the filibuster used to stop gun control legislation from moving through the Senate. And so he's certainly more than willing to use this as part of his, fuel to the fire on this to get rid of the Senate, to get rid of the filibuster and make the Senate work just like the House of Representatives, where things would move through by simple majority, and which would be, it would change the entire political landscape of America. And you would have whipsaw effects back and forth.
I was going to say, doesn't that just mean the next time that the Republicans have, majority of the Senate, they're going to do the same thing back and forth? It's like, I feel like.
Yeah. And that's exactly this past week in the Wall Street Journal. Actually, Senator McConnell, who was the previous majority leader up until this last election, he's now the minority leader for the Republicans. He is warning that it will become a scorched earth policy in the Senate. Hit every 4 years, whoever's in charge, or every 2 years, depending on how the elections go, because every senators are up for election every 6 years on alternating terms, you could have a complete burn down of everything that was accomplished in the previous session. So that is going to be very difficult way to govern our nation, and it's going to be counterproductive over time. I mean, the whole idea is that we don't rule by, the country by extremes, right? We want to make sure that everyone's coming together and there's some level of compromise. We're all meeting in the middle. And this is not going to help us to do that. So.
Right. Well, what are some of the things you think that we can do as gun owners to influence what happens with this bill?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is you got to make sure you're educated on it, and you have to reach out to your senator. And those who may be, listening to this and kind of throwing their hands in the air saying, this is all lost. Well, it's not. I think that there are still a couple of centrist senators. There may not be a whole lot of them left. Centrist Democrat senators who really are going to have a very difficult time swallowing a vote for gun control. I think if you look to Senator Manchin out of West Virginia, people are here. Senator Sinema out of Arizona, Senator Heinrich out of New Mexico, and Senator Tester out of Montana. These are all senators who have supported pro-gun measures. And these are all senators who have states that they represent with very strong Second Amendment and hunting traditions in those states. And they would have a very difficult time to go back to those states and tell them how they voted against issues that were important to their voters.
Right.
Senator Manchin wrote the last attempt at what could be close to a universal background check bill. He and Senator Toomey. Senator Toomey, he's going to retire in 2 years. He said he's not going to run again. And he's the Republican on that side of that bill. I think that both Senator Manchin and Senator Toomey would love another bite at the apple to get across the finish line on what they wanted to do back in 2013. Mm-hmm. But even Senator Toomey has come out and said that the way this bill is written, H.R. 8, is not nearly focused narrowly enough that he could support this bill. So I don't think you'll find Senator Manchin along for the ride on that one. So I think you're going to find it very difficult to convince some of these, any of these four senators that they have to vote for these bills. Now, Senator Schumer said he will put the bill up for a procedural vote. Mm-hmm. And it will at least allow senators to say, okay, are we going to move this forward and debate on this, or are we going to just let it die on the floor? And that was what's happening before. They sent this bill over, the same bill, so over in the last Congress, they sent it over to Senator McConnell. Senator McConnell said, thank you very much, and it died right there on the doorstep of the Senate. And it's not going to go anywhere. But again, the whole idea is that the Senate is supposed to be the area where they let things kind of cool down a little bit. And there may be some hot heads over in the House of Representatives that are going to push things that are just not good for America. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are. You took a look at the bill, and National Registry, first and foremost, is antithetical to who we are as a nation. The idea that we're going to be watched and monitored by our government for the free exercise of our rights is unacceptable at the beginning.
It's scary is what it is.
It's very scary.
Yeah, it's very scary. Because, I feel like that all that's going to do is push people to a civil war of some sort. And, I don't want to end up like some other, South American country or whatever that's constantly warring.
It's a terrible thought to think that way. Listen, I served in the Marine Corps for 25 years. I fought in Iraq and I fought in Afghanistan, and I was in shooting matches in several places of the world before that. I've been parts of this world where things can go very badly very quickly, and it's a terrible toll on human life. It's a terrible toll on a nation's identity. And I certainly don't want to see that come to the nation that I serve and love. And I actually still have a responsibility to. I'm retired, which means I'm still subject to my oath of service to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want to see any of that violence come to my nation or have that visited upon my family or my children or my neighbors. I may passionately disagree with my neighbors on what those issues are, but isn't that who we are as a nation, right? We're a bunch of people who can passionately disagree. Well, we're going to do that in a civil manner. We're going to do that with mutual respect for one another. And somewhere along the way, we've lost this idea of mutual respect for one another's ideas. And we can disagree with your ideas, and we can do that in a way that's not disagreeable. And I think that's kind of where we need to get back to is let's debate these ideas. And you can argue passionately against them, but at the end of the day, realize that we're neighbors and we're a nation and we're united in this together. And we have to find a middle way about doing this. Again, from our perspective, I'm not telling everyone in America that you have to own a gun. Choose not to. That's your decision. What I'm telling you is my decision to become a gun owner and to purchase a firearm. Is my decision, and that is my willingness to exercise my right. And there's nothing to take that right away from me. The government does not have the authority to take that right away from me if I'm a law-abiding citizen. And that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. I also want to thank you for your service.
No, thank you.
And hopefully, we can make a we can make it a little push, a little grassroots push here, and see if we can affect some change, because I certainly don't want this to happen.
Yeah.
I see the implications, not only, on our rights, but I also see the implications that it might have on wildlife and hunting, because Pittman-Robinson Act is so, tied to gun sales and ammunition sales, and it might affect all
Yeah,
that, and I just
you're absolutely right.
so.
Yeah, we had 21 billion background checks for the sale of a gun last year. And you and I both know right now finding any ammunition, that's a chore. We start to look at the money that has been produced through the Pittman-Robertson Act. Over the past year, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put out a press release about 2 weeks ago, announcing that they had written a billion-dollar check to the states to be able to push into their state wildlife programs. And that all comes from Pittman-Robertson dollars, as well as your archery taxes and some of the taxes that are on fishing gear. That was $121 million higher than it was in 2019, and that's because of that 10 and 11% tax that's paid by the manufacturers. That's baked into the cost of every gun and every cartridge you buy. They're going for wildlife, and it's doing tremendous things. I mean, it's we can take it for granted the abundant wildlife we have in America today, but that was not the case when they wrote this act in 1937. There were hardly any, Rocky Mountain elk left. Seeing a whitetail in the woods was something that got everyone's attention in town. It was the talk of the town if you saw a whitetail. Wild turkeys weren't nearly what they were. Ducks weren't nearly what they were. And it was because of the market hunting and the poaching that was happening during the Depression.
Right.
And they luckily had the foresight then to say, we need to make sure we can perpetuate wildlife in America for future generations. And just think of how different America would be right now
Oh,
if we didn't have the
crazy.
wildlife that we do.
Crazy.
Our complete character would be totally different. And we really have to thank those people who had the foresight to do it, but it really is, that money that's being generated from the sale of these firearms and ammunition. And 70% of those is actually tied to recreational shooters. It's those people who may never hunt,
Yep.
but they're going to go to the woods. And they may never go into the woods, but they're going to go out, shoot off, paper targets and maybe a little bit of steel and maybe shoot around a sporting place, and all that money that they're spending to do that is supporting those manufacturers who are paying that tax, and it's going into that. So it's a tremendous benefit that we're providing, not just for us as hunters, but for the bird watchers and for the environmentalists and the naturists who just want to go out and enjoy nature.
Yeah.
And those dollars don't just pay for the animals that we love to chase. It's not just helping us get
Oh.
more elk to be able to chase after through
It
the
trickles
woods.
down to a lot of
It's also,
stuff.
yeah, I mean, that money was used to help bring the bald eagle back. And we're never going to hunt the bald eagle.
Right.
I just went up to Connecticut to do a bear den study with their state biologists up there. And all that money that is being perpetuated through Pittman-Robertson dollars funds those studies. It pays for the radio collar they put on the sow. It pays for the serum to dart the sow. It pays for all the data and all the study to go into to be able to put all that information together. And here's the kicker. You can't hunt bears in Connecticut.
Yeah.
They want to get to the point where they say, and the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection in Connecticut, which is their Fish and Wildlife Department, they advocate that, yes, we should be hunting bears because we have a healthy, sustainable, growing population that's growing at a rate of 10 to 15% a year. But right now, you can't hunt bear in Connecticut. But the Pittman-Robertson dollars are helping to establish the information that we need to be able to say the bear are doing great. And probably in the next 15 to 20 years, it won't just be the western half of the state of Connecticut. There'll be bear throughout the entire state,
Yep.
other states too. And again, it's just not just for hunting species that we may be able to chase after and harvest. It's saving conservation land so that they have the environment in which they can live. It's studying ferns. It's studying salamanders and frogs and all the other things that make a viable ecosystem viable. And so it's a very important thing that we do as hunters and as recreational shooters to support conservation. We should be very, very proud of that.
Yeah, here's the biggest thing with that is you and I know this, and the majority of hunters know this. I'd say the majority, but it's maybe not even the majority, but a large portion of the hunters know this. But the problem is everybody else doesn't know that. And it's on us to start educating those people that are in the middle. Don't engage with anti-hunters because you're not going to change their minds. But the people who are in the middle, we need to educate them. So educate yourself on this.
Yeah.
If you're listening to this podcast, educate yourself on this. And that way you can talk, and not sound like I do right now, fumbling for words, but just educate yourself so you can educate the non-hunting public. And then when stuff like this comes up, they have a better idea of all the workings of how everything is all tied together and the beautiful system that we have in place that every other country in the world wishes they had. So,
And I really think, I think probably the best thing that we can do as hunters and as recreational shooters is to grow one more just like us. And that's why NSSF has embraced this, what we call the plus one movement. And that's just a challenge. It's a challenge to every single one of us that, this year, invite someone to go out with you into the woods, invite someone to go with you to the range and teach them what it is about our sport, about our pastime, about our heritage that makes us so passionate about that and share that with them. I don't think that you or I probably have ever taken anybody to a range and they didn't walk away with a smile on their face. Or if you've taken someone out and you've been able to take them on their first hunt and watch while they harvested their first animal, knowing the work that they put into it and the appreciation for the wildlife that they've had to be able to get that clean source of meat and be able to put that meat into the freezer and then from the freezer to the table and feed their family with something they harvested with their own hands. There's a deep appreciation that goes with that. And I think, if we want to make a true difference in that, it starts with the person who lives probably right next door to you and just have that conversation and invite them. You'd be surprised, I think, how many people would take you up on that offer.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to play devil's advocate. I know a lot of people hear that and they say, well, I don't want any more competition in the woods. And believe me, I fight it all the time because it's tough. I fight it internally all the time. It's tough for me to say, I want to see more people involved. And then you go out and you see tons of, red jackets and red hats out there and you can't, but,
I think we're all looking for a couple thousand acres we can call our own, right?
Right.
Exactly. But it's all these things I ask a lot of hunters too, and a lot, especially recreational shooters, because it can be an intimidating thing to get into when you just don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And I ask them about, well, who was the first person who took you to a range? And, who was the first person who took you out into the woods or out into the marsh and sitting in a duck blind? And when they stop and they think about it, well, it was my dad or it was my uncle or it was my older brother or maybe my mom took me. What if that person in your neighborhood doesn't have that person in their life? What if those people never grew up with a hunting tradition? Because we know that hunters are aging out. And actually this past year, hunting licenses rose for the first time across the nation, because of the pandemic. On a nice slow decline that had been going on, but we're starting, hopefully seeing that trend reverse a little bit. But the idea is that, maybe some of these people around you didn't grow up with that tradition, just never been exposed to it, but they've got kids who would love to have the chance to do that. And someone did that for you. It was someone in your life who recognized that you had that spark and said, I'm going to nurture this a little bit and I'm going to teach them the right way to do this. And I'm going to teach them to be a responsible and ethical hunter. I'm going to teach them to be a safe marksman. And I'm going to teach them the right way to do this and how to step through the woods and to make sure that firearm is always on safe until you're ready to squeeze that trigger. And it's always those little lessons that someone needs to teach someone new to the sport. So, while I would love to be able to spend time on my own couple thousand acres, I have a bigger kick these days out of watching someone harvest their first animal. I get a bigger kick out of watching that smile of someone knowing that they've been able to master that skill of target marksmanship, You know, I took my son-in-law out for his first deer hunt last year, and he harvested. It was, you know, just a little button buck. But he harvested that little button buck. But you know something, that button buck, that little spiky shot, is going to be just as important to him as that, you know, beautiful 8-point that he'll put on, or 10-point that he'll put on the wall someday, because that was his first deer ever.
Yep.
And how important is that first deer ever to a hunter? I'll never forget my first deer. And I don't think any hunter ever does. And how important it was to have that experience. And I was able to be there and give that experience to him, knowing that he'll be able to give that experience to my grandson. So, you know, perpetuate that legacy. Build the next generation of hunters who's going to be able to enjoy it. And let's be honest, we're all going to get old someday, right? We're going to need someone to take us.
Yeah, exactly.
Come up the side of the mountain, and maybe we just want to sit in the box stand. We're going to need someone to take us. So, you know, think about it that way. Who's going to take you hunting when you can't drag that deer out anymore?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, awesome. Thank you so much again for coming on. And it was a good conversation. I hope we can get something out of it. And I wish you good luck out there, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, anytime, John. I'm glad to be part of this and glad to speak with you. Anytime you guys have questions, please let me know. We'll always be glad to help out.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Y'all take care. Bye.
Bye.